Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Each week, Inside Education brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish point of view. My name is Sean Delaney and it's good to have your company today. This week's programme is a landmark one because it is the 250th edition of Inside Education. Since the first programme was broadcast on the 12th of July 2009, we have featured over 370 guests from Ireland, the United States, the United Kingdom and beyond on the 250 programmes. They include classroom teachers, policymakers, policy analysts, university lecturers, researchers, poets, philosophers, students, union representatives and many more. What they all have in common is a story to tell about teaching and learning. The topics featured too have been wide-ranging, including literacy, numeracy and all subjects of the school curriculum, technology, teacher education, plagiarism, data smog, assessment, innovation in education, economics, the role of parents, research methods and much more. The good news is that all 250 programmes are still available to you for listening or for download as podcasts. If you'd like to see a list of programmes on one webpage, you can go to seandelaney.com/podcasts. Alternatively, you may like to see a list of guests who featured on the programme. You can access that list by going to insideed.com and clicking on the Guests alphabetical tab on the top of the page. On this week's programme, I bring you the second part of my interview with Orla Kelly, the co-author with Roger Cutting of Creative Teaching in Primary Science and a lecturer in the Church of Ireland College of Education in Rathmines. The chapters in the book include Introducing Creative Science, Pedagogical Approaches and the Teaching of Science, The Importance of Teacher Knowledge in Science, Planning and Assessing Creative Approaches in Science, Working Scientifically and Creative Science Through Drama and Storytelling. At the end of the interview on last week's programme, Orla explained how she and her co-author applied a problem-based learning approach to teaching prospective primary school teachers at the University of Plymouth. I asked Orla what kind of problems they used with the prospective teachers.
This particular module was to develop their own science as opposed to necessarily teaching them about primary science. So it was problems at university kind of level. Not all of them would have studied each of the sciences. So we sort of had to do, introductory problems. So one of them I remember was the great egg drop. So the building that we were in was on six floors. So we basically gave them the challenge that they had to drop an egg out of the top floor without it breaking. So that was it, you know. They could use whatever materials they wanted, and they had to come up though with some way to get the egg down to the ground without it breaking. So we had parachutes, we had the eggs totally being covered with lots and lots of padding and being dropped, and some eggs broke before they even left the sixth floor. But that's an example, and we would then reflect on the science behind their different methods, you know. So why did they choose a parachute? What was going on there with that? You know, why did they choose to pad it? Or some of them built kind of little cages and then, you know, tried to sort of get them to fly and, you know, all sorts of stuff. Not very successful. But again, we talked about why they had gone wrong, or what the science really was that they were trying to.
But there were some successes.
There were some successes. Yes, it wasn't all bad. But usually there was more breakages than success.
And who is the book for, Orla?
The book is for trainee teachers, so students who are on Bachelor of Education programmes or maybe postgraduate courses, but also for teachers who have an interest in science, who are maybe looking to maybe change their practice or to embrace, you know, different methods in their practice.
So can you say a little bit about the chapters in the book and how it's organised?
Yeah, sure. So there's sort of two main sections to the book. Part one sort of looks at the general aspects of teaching. So around pedagogical approaches, teacher knowledge, planning and assessing in science and the use of technology. And then the second part actually looks at particular strategies. So like that, using art and design, using drama, using the outdoors, thinking about health and well-being. So, you know, different sort of, I suppose, themes or subjects that you could use to teach science.
And how is creative science teaching different to regular science teaching?
Well, I suppose First of all, maybe just to talk a little bit about what we mean by creativity. When we talk about creativity, it's sort of little c creativity, you know. It's children making new connections, you know, so things that are obvious to us, but it's putting them in a situation where they suddenly realize that actually by doing this, this happens, and oh, that relates to that. I suppose it's them developing their knowledge, but them maybe coming up with it themselves. So to be creative, children need to do, well, we all need to do two things to be creative. One is to generate ideas. So that generation of ideas. So we need to be generative thinkers and coming up with lots of ideas. But if we just do that, we can go off in any direction with, and we might develop or come up with an idea that's not fit for purpose or that doesn't make sense. Or so you also need to have the evaluative thinking. So a creative thinker goes between those two, the generating of ideas and evaluating their ideas, and constantly going back and forth with those till they hopefully come up with an idea that makes sense and that fits, if you like. In science then, I mean, I think being creative is a natural part of science. You know, I don't see science as, you know, one science being not creative and the other science being creative. It's very much part of it. So like that, when we're investigating, we want to be starting off with those generation of ideas, going back to, say, the egg drop. You know, let's just try things out. Let's, okay, we could like that, build a parachute, or we could try to make something that flies and that, you know, glides down and hits the ground smoothly. We could maybe make just some big bubble thing that will drop it safely down. Or you might come up with something completely off the wall. And so then you have to go, well, actually, okay, well, which of those might work best? So that's when you bring in the bit of evaluative thinking and go, okay, well, actually, that one really isn't going to work as well, but this one might. And naturally, I think we, you know, creativity is there, and it's just a case of, I think, being aware of it and maybe helping others to see that creativity.
I suppose the fact that it's in the title of your book is kind of suggesting that it is a little bit different to regular teaching. That's why I was asking that question.
Okay, so it is different. I suppose the book starts off with sort of saying, if you're looking for a primary science book that gives you lots of worksheets and photocopial sort of resources, then this is not the book for you. So it's about stepping back maybe from our understanding of science and maybe challenging the idea that science isn't creative, because I think most people probably don't associate science being creative. So we start off with addressing that why is science creative, and that science doesn't have to be in contrast to the arts, that actually they can be quite complementary. And when you look back historically, a lot of very famous inventors and scientists have been very, very strongly artistic as well. And the skills that they draw from are actually what more of the same. So in terms of why this science is different, it's using different approaches. It's like that, bringing in drama, it's bringing in art, it's bringing in maybe music to your classroom, to your science classroom. It's using maybe themes that you wouldn't naturally associate with science to the classroom. So, for example, like health and well-being, that, you know, you kind of think that sits in SPAG, but in fact, science can support understanding around health and well-being, but also that can help teach science, you know. So it's sort of looking at the complementary aspects of different subjects.
Because as well as a chapter on health and well-being, you have one on a science of equality. What's that chapter about?
We're very aware, you know, in recent times of diversity in, you know, in classrooms, in the wider world. And we all too often focus on the differences between us and other people, or, you know, differences amongst, you know, children in a classroom or whatever it might be. But actually, when you look at it from a science point of view, we're 99.9% in terms of genes similar. You know, so there's a huge, we're much more similar than we maybe on the outward that we look like. So it's maybe beginning to kind of explore some of those ideas that actually we're much more equal than we are different. So that would be one of the ideas that we kind of look at in the book.
And you also have a subheading called The Myth of Scientific Method. What does that refer to?
So the myth of the scientific method, I suppose. And I've mentioned some of the words already. When we think about the scientific method, it's about observation, investigating, maybe predicting results, you know, conclusions. So there's a lot of kind of terminology around. And then if you think about findings or results, you know, we're talking about accuracy and precision. And so it can get maybe a bit technical and a little bit like that, maybe off-putting for someone who's maybe not confident in the sciences. But while they are all aspects of the scientific method, really what the scientific method is questioning the world around us and then doing something to help answer those questions. That's, you know, so it's kind of busting that myth that it has to be all of those things and it has to somehow be very scientific in that traditional sense, like that of maybe being accurate and precise. And well, there are all aspects that we would want to include sometimes. When you just strip it all back, it's about questioning and then trying to answer questions.
And do you think it's important for children to learn about famous scientists and how they worked?
I think that can be part of the learning, just to sort of see sometimes the most big inventions haven't happened from, you know, someone going, I'm going to investigate this. And they actually follow some linear procedure and eventually go, ah, yes. Often things are discovered by chance, you know, and just with my students the other day, I had set them a task and it was looking, I teach history as well, so they were looking at timelines and they'd looked at sort of inventions that had, you know, over the last century. And in terms of the microwave, this particular scientist, he had been working in whatever job he was doing. I don't even know if he was actually a scientist. And but he was working around radiation, microwaves, and he had a chocolate bar in his pocket, and the chocolate bar had melted after whatever, maybe his day in work. And he sort of went, hey, what's going on here? And so it was from something totally random that he then said, oh, something's going on here. And then he actually developed the microwave from that. You know, so I think sharing some of those stories can show that it's not just, you know, someone doesn't say, right, I'm going to investigate this question, and then they answer it. That sometimes it's just random observations can lead to very big investigations. Or sometimes it can take, you know, one person might take it so far and then someone else takes it on. And
standing on the shoulders of giants.
Well, exactly, yeah.
And are there particular scientists that you admire that you kind of think every child should know about, this scientist or that scientist?
Not really. I think... For a teacher, you know, we probably might identify with different scientists. I suppose I'm a chemist at heart, so you know, Marie Curie as a woman as well. I would probably, that's who I, you know, would if I was going to be, you know, going for a scientist to share with children. That's who I'd look at. But I think someone that, you know, if you have a personal not a personal connection, but someone that maybe means something to you for whatever reason, you know. Yeah, it's good to probably have a couple of scientists that you like to talk about and that you can identify with.
You currently work as a teacher educator in the Church of Ireland College of Education. Can you tell us a little bit about the career path that brought you to there?
So I probably already mentioned that I did a science degree. So I studied analytical science in Dublin City University. And before starting that, I always had it in my head that I'd be a secondary science teacher. My dad was a secondary science teacher and... You know, I kind of always had this teaching side of me. So I figured I'll just do a science degree and then I'll do teaching. But I chose the Dublin City University degree because they offered a work placement for 6 months and in industry. And I said, oh, maybe that's something that I'll really like. So I, you know, did my 6 months work placement. And while I had a very worthwhile and very useful 6 months placement, it wasn't for me. So having finished my degree, my supervisor for my dissertation asked me what I was going to do. And I said, well, I'll apply for my postgrad and do my diploma to become a teacher. And she said, well, in the meantime, she said, do you want to do some research in education, in science education? And I said, well, that sounds great. So that sort of started off as being a master's, but then turned into a PhD in science education, looking at the use of problem-based learning to teach undergraduate science, well, chemistry. And when that finished, I absolutely loved it. I loved research in education, but I had the opportunity during that time to also do some in-service work with teachers, with practicing teachers, and I loved sharing the kind of ideas and things I was working on with them, and, you know, knowing that that was actually going to impact on practice in the classroom. So I kind of begun to think about maybe teaching teachers would be something I'd like to do. And then I had the opportunity to work in St. Patrick's College and do some teaching on their B.Ed program. And again, that further kind of consolidated, yeah, this is what I'd really like to do. So Having finished my PhD, did the usual applying for some jobs, and one came up in Plymouth University, and having lived in Dublin all my life at that stage, I took the plunge and I got the job over there. So I taught on a Bachelor of Education programme over there for 6.5 years and learned lots over there. And I suppose I felt that, you know, it was time to move jobs, whether within England or, you know, to come back home. I suppose I got to the stage where I was team leading in Plymouth, and you know, I was now nearly mentoring other people, and I said, no, I still need to learn. So I wanted to, I suppose, a new challenge. And then the job came up in the Church of Ireland College of Education, and this was definitely going to be a challenge, because as well as teaching science, which I had been exclusively doing in Plymouth, with a little bit of drama, I was also going to be doing history and geography if I was, you know, if I got the post in Church of Ireland College, because the curriculum, SCSE in Ireland, obviously teaches the three. So I got the role, and so that's how I got there. And it's you know, the geography was probably an easier subject to sort of take on. You know, it's my own probably personal interest, but also I found a lot of similarities between it and science. But the history definitely was that was a challenge taking that on. Yeah.
And what do you think of the grouping of those three subjects? Because we've already said that science itself, you know, has all these sub-disciplines. But, you know, the fact that we organise our curriculum to have science, history and geography together as one subject, what do you make of that?
I think that at times it's a really, really good model to have, that the three of them come together, because there's such an overlap between them. I think most people could quite easily think of links between history and geography, and probably geography and science. I think sometimes the science and history can be a bit more challenging in terms of linking. But my students, when they go out on placement, they would teach SCSE, you know, through an integrated topic. So they often will have a topic and they look at science, history and geography. And I think it can really enrich the learning of each subject, so long, again, as there's each subject still has its focus. You know, I think the danger can be that maybe someone focuses mostly on the history and the little bit of science is just tucked in somewhere in the lesson, or equally there might be a big focus on the geography and the science might lose out. And I suppose I have a bias towards science because that's my own subject, but I think it does teachers maybe lack of confidence in that. I think it's easier for them to spend a little less time maybe on that, or for the science to become a bit diluted when there's the other subjects there. So that would be my caveat, that I think it can work really well having the three subjects together, and it can really enrich and you can look at some really exciting topics, but just making sure that each of the subjects still has, you know, the integrity and very clear objectives. Yeah.
And did you notice any differences in the teaching of science in England when you were in Plymouth and the teaching of science in Ireland, particularly in primary schools?
Well, I think one of the things that I was really pleased to see was that there's actually a lot more science going on here than there is in England, which I think surprises most people.
Yeah.
So even though science is a core subject in England, it can maybe be, it's maybe only taught once a week, and then lots of schools might choose to do a term where they'll teach a topic and they'll do their science in 6 weeks or in 10 weeks, and then the children don't do science then for the rest of the year. Whereas I think here, you know, children are engaged in science every, you know, at least every week or every couple of weeks, if there may be some teachers might focus on some of the SCSE subjects in 1 week. And so I've actually seen a lot more science here than all the time I was in England. And one of the things that amazes people is that even though I was over there for 6.5 years and doing school placements, you know, supervising school placement all that time, I only saw one science lesson. Yeah. Whereas here I've seen, you know, already seen a lot more.
And would you notice a difference in the content of the lessons or how they're organised?
I suppose, because I didn't observe many science lessons on placement, but I would have gone into a school and worked with them quite closely on their science. So I think the content is quite similar. I would say that we have the integration with SCSE allows maybe more topics to be maybe brought in, and that enriches the science. But I'd say that the methods, I'd say, are very similar, and the kind of, you know, the approach. I think they're developing their inquiry-based learning as well, which, you know, has been pushed here as well. So,
and your own interest in science, did that come from, you said your father was a science teacher, did it come from him or did it come from teachers you had in primary or post-primary school?
Well, in primary school, the only kind of science I remember doing was the nature table, which I'm sure lots of people might remember as well. So it probably came, my own love, certainly my father would have been very encouraging, you know, and he was more of a biologist. So when we'd be out, you know, he knew always the names of trees and leaves and, you know, plants and birds. And, you know, so I was kind of all the time, if I had those questions, he was able to foster that curiosity. So that certainly helped. And then when I went to secondary school, I did science and I just loved the practical. I loved the hands-on part. And then I studied chemistry and physics for Leaving Cert, or sorry, chemistry and biology for Leaving Cert. And again, I loved the chemistry and I had a great chemistry teacher. So that certainly fostered that, you know, that direction and the chemistry rather than the biology. And even now when I think about how things work, I think about them on a molecular level in terms of a chemistry understanding. My husband is a physicist and he thinks about them in a very different way. So it's funny how he sort of says, how can you not understand it in this way? And I say, well, how can you not understand it in this way? That there's just, you know, for me, chemistry made sense. As soon as I started looking at things at a molecular level, it all came together for me and I was able to then, you know, really begin to understand, you know, how we work and how plants and animals work.
And when did that happen for you?
It's really hard to pinpoint. Certainly towards the end of kind of my Leaving Cert chemistry, there was some aspects of it that were very mathematical, but you could correlate those maths aspects to actual molecules and how when two things came together, they had so much energy and maybe they either released or gave up energy. And being able to map it out numerically, coupled with seeing that these were particular molecules.
So it's quite an abstract idea. So are you visualizing it or are you, you know, how are you making sense of this, of the molecularization of things?
It's hard to know whether it's visual. I think because I can relate it to, as you said, it is very abstract, you know, thinking about these molecules coming together and then possibly energy being given off or taken and then something new being made and other things being given off. But I think when I begun to think about it as when these things, you know, the energy, which I could actually put that down as a number, that so much energy was actually released and you could, it's tricky. I don't know, but maybe a bit of visualizing it and just it made sense. It's hard to know. Then I think when I went to university, then there was a lot more ideas to grapple with and I probably got back down into not having that very clear understanding. And then again, probably just emerged.
And what was your study at university focused on chemistry or did you look at some biology and physics?
Yeah, I looked at biology and physics. So I would have done all three subjects and maths for 2 years. And then I dropped physics at that stage. And then we either, the degree was designed that you either took chemistry or biology as your major. But you studied the two of them up though to fourth year. So, but I suppose I did my dissertation around chemistry topic. So that really just furthered my that definitely helped with the understanding and with really kind of getting my ideas clear in my head. And I think that as well came back to the why I started to look at problem-based learning was that for me, when I look back at my own degree, I was, you know, I was successful in first, second and third year. I, you know, did my labs, I did my practicals and got on well with my exams. But it wasn't until I did my dissertation that I actually felt like I was actually doing science. Because I was able to look at a topic and go, oh, you know, I've done a bit of reading and this is maybe something I could try. And then I try that and then I say, okay, well, that's helped me a little bit to understand this. But there's this other element that I didn't think of. And, you know, so I felt I was actually doing science. I was actually being a scientist, whereas up until then I was preparing to be a scientist. I was learning the techniques and learning the theory. But, you know, so I kind of felt, why do we have to leave that part until the end? You know, so I wanted to kind of bring some of that problem base, some of that, you know, developing your own science.
Exploration, is it?
Exploration, really, yeah, earlier on in the in degree. So that when my PhD looked at using problem-based learning with first-year undergraduates.
Okay.
So I suppose to kind of bring in some of that, that they can begin to come up with their own questions, begin to think about different methods. I think the other side is really important as well, that they still would learn the techniques and would, you know, learned that when you want to, say, test for something, that this is how you test it. And but why not bring in some of that exploration and give them a little bit of trying things out, you know?
Who or what inspires you?
People inspire me. I'm inspired by I'm amazed by the world around me. I just had a baby, well, I have an 8-month-old baby, and, you know, just amazed at how that all works, you know, and that's obviously been my recent personal experience. But even just seeing a little seed, and how from a little seed you can then get a plant, and then that plant can keep growing, and, you know, yeah, it's very complicated stuff, but yeah, it does amaze me and it fascinates me. I think that probably that more natural side of things, and how we work as, you know, as humans, probably appeals to me a bit more than maybe how a plane works or something, you know, a tank or something, or cars.
An expression of the wonder of science by Orla Kelly, bringing this week's programme to a close. I was speaking to Orla Kelly to mark the publication by Sage Publishing of the book she co-authored with Roger Cutting, titled Creative Teaching in Primary Science. The book has been very well received to date. For example, Wynne Harlan, who is an author and consultant in science education, writes that this book combines argument and evidence about the importance of creativity in teaching and learning with ideas for classroom activities that go beyond the usual run of science topics. Yet these experiences are essential if we are to achieve the aims of developing thoughtful young people who care for the environment and for their own and others' well-being. Carl Longmore from Wolverhampton notes that the book is more suited to initial teacher training, but a wonderful book regardless. Well, I want to thank my guest, Orla Kelly, who lectures in the Church of Ireland College of Education. And the Church of Ireland College of Education is in the process of becoming part of the new Dublin City University, DCU, Institute of Education. DCU will then accredit the college's B.Ed degree, Master of Education in Special Education Needs, and its postgraduate diploma in Learning Support and Special Education Needs. On this, the 250th edition of Inside Education, I'd like to thank all our listeners, new and established, for your support of the programme and your feedback on it. It's your interaction that makes it all worthwhile. If you like what you heard on today's programme, please tell your friends about it by sharing links to the programme's website on social media like Twitter and Facebook. The website through which you can access all 250 programmes to date is seandelaney.com/podcasts. You can get in touch with the programme by emailing feedback or suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.